Welcome to The Grange Point, where we hang out and talk about the latest news in science technology and how they relate to your everyday life. This podcast is brought to you by the Young Scientists of Australia. We're a youth organisation aged 15 to 25 whose work is to promote science to the youth of Australia.
Coming up with novel ways to produce that next generation of materials. Now, magnets are a pretty handy thing, but you can use shape-changing, squishing and squeezing to change magnetic fields and electric currents and make a next generation of computer chips. You can also use squishing and grinding and crushing to actually produce luminescent polymers to create that next generation of smart devices. You might have heard some large electrical equipment making a humming noise. If you walk past a fluorescent light, or maybe an electricity transformer sitting atop a power pole, or maybe a large one near a piece of industrial equipment, or even your maybe laptop's charger bank, all of these things often can emit a humming noise. Now, that humming noise is actually a pretty interesting phenomenon taking place. It's actually being caused by magnetostriction. Now, this is phenomena occurs when a material's shape and their magnetic field get interwoven together, particularly in the case of anything with a large amount of ferrite in it, say a transformer. For those of you who aren't aware, transformers are generally used from converting from one voltage level to another, and traditionally they involve things wound around a large iron core, or some laminated sections. Now, these transformers are a pretty useful tool for the modern world, but their shape is related to their magnetic field, and thus they hum. In the same way, a fluorescent light tube, even though its actual process of what's happening inside a fluorescent light tube is very, very different to that of a transformer, its magnetic field is linked intrinsically to its shape. A change in shape causes a change in the magnetic field. Now, that's the principle of magnetostriction. It's all basing back to, obviously, the fundamental laws as we understand them from Maxwell and Faraday, that electricity and magnetism linked as part of the electromagnetic spectrum. You can't have one without the other. Magnetic field, you will see a corresponding electric field and vice versa. So if you influence the electric field, well, you influence the magnetic field. Now, in the case of magnetostriction, if you influence the shape of something, well, you result in a change in the magnetic field. This is fascinating. But that principle can be used to induce electrical currents. You squeeze or change the shape of something, it changes the magnetic field in some other way, and all of a sudden you get a different electrical output. This is really useful for medical devices and certain sensor types, because you can use this physical change in shape to translate to some precise measurement. These can be used in all kinds of devices called magnetoelectrics or electronics. Now, a group of researchers, including collaborators from University of Michigan, researchers from Intel, Cornell University, University of California, Berkeley, University of Wisconsin, Purdue, and others all collaborated, I think a long list of researchers, in a paper published in the journal Nature Communications. Now, lead author was P.B. Messenheimer and R.A. Steinhardt, along with a large number of others, working together to develop the new generation of magnetoelectric devices and the materials that form them. Now, traditional electronic devices, they send all of their information backwards and forwards in binary. We call this ones and zeros, on or off. This is a pretty straightforward thing to do with electricity because it's either on or it's off. That makes it very efficient for transferring information, but it requires that information, and electricity in this case, to always be flowing. So it's not particularly efficient because you have to use a constant stream of electricity to transfer this information. Electricity, as it appears, so does the information in some ways too. So if you had a way of transferring this information using something else, well, this would be pretty interesting to consider. And a magnetoelectric device uses magnetic fields instead of electricity to store all of that digital ones and zeros of binary data. Tiny pulses of electricity cause them to expand or contract slightly. This may not be a lot, might be a very, very small movement, but it's enough to change the magnetic field from a positive to a negative, or vice versa. That's significant because by applying a tiny bit of electricity, you cause a structural change. That structural change then doesn't need electricity to keep it held in that position. You don't need that constant flow of electrons that we find in electricity to keep them powered and storing that information, or processing it for that matter. That's a great achievement because it means that you can use a fraction of the energy of traditional silicon chips and computer electronics. The problem is, how do you squeeze so much into a tiny space? And that's a chip problem that everyone who makes chips, like say Intel or others, continually runs into. The problem with magneto-electric devices is finding materials whose electric and magnetic properties are linked, along with their shape. That's what key author John Herron, an engineering professor from University of Michigan, outlined. And more magneto restrictions means that a chip can do the same job with less energy. Now, most of the materials used today to make a magneto-restrictive material all rely on rare earth elements. Now, they're called rare earth elements for a reason. They're scarce, they're hard to find, and hard to commercially mine. So they're costly to be used in quantities. And the thing is, a lot of our sophisticated electronics, smart batteries, green energy technology, motors, drives, mobile phones, cars, you name it, they all need these rare earth metals. And they're rare. So they're not ideal for what you want to build a new technology around. But they're very powerful. And what researchers like John Herron and others involved in this study was found a way to coax high levels of magneto restriction, not from rare, unusual elements, but from rather common ones, inexpensive materials like iron and gallium. Now, the thing is, iron and gallium as an alloy can produce magneto restriction. And in general, if you add more gallium into the mix, you get more and more magneto restriction. Now, that's great, but eventually it hits a plateau. It's a taper where there's too much gallium and they form a nice ordered structure around the iron. This ordered atomic structure means that you can add in heaps and heaps and heaps more gallium, but you don't get any gain from it. And that means you effectively run into a limiting factor. So what do you do? If you want to make iron and gallium as an alloy into something that's quite very easily able to form this magneto-restrictive material, you need to think out of the box. Now, this is where the team used a process called low-temperature molecular beam epitaxy. Now, this seems like a big word, but essentially what they're using here is cold to slow the movement of these atoms and basically prevent them from arranging themselves in this nice, neat, ordered structure. If that gallium doesn't form this big, rigid structure around the iron, well, you can keep throwing in more and more gallium, massively increasing the density of the gallium in this alloy. Herron and his team were able to double the amount of gallium in the material, but because they prevented it from wrapping and structuring itself around the iron, they were able to get a tenfold increase in the magneto restriction. So, think about this another way. For twice as much gallium, they got a 10 times boost in magneto restriction. That's a pretty good return on investment. I would take those numbers at any day. Now, low temperature molecular beam epitaxy is a pretty useful technique. It's a bit like spray painting with individual atoms, as Herron states. And spray painting the material onto a surface that deforms slightly when voltage is applied has also made it easy to test magneto-restrictive properties. This is the key thing here. The process that they've used to make this magneto-restrictive material, A, uses cheap and readily available materials, not rare earth metals. That's good. The second thing is the actual process itself, well, it can be done as a spray, and but since it's done as a spray, it's perfect for a coating. A coating on a large device, a coating on a small device, a coating on a wafer, you name it. And that's how it fits into chipmakers like Intel's plans. Of course, they're not large. We're talking about something which is freezing in place, a structure of atoms. So we're not talking about big scale. These magneto-electric devices that are made as part of this study were only several microns in size. When we talk about computer chips, they're often in the nanometer size. So that's pretty big by computing standards. But for us walking around, microns is reasonably small. Now, what they're trying to do is find a way to get this down to the electronic chip level, this nanometer scale. If we can get down that level, well, that makes it applicable to use in a special way to actually form that next generation of computing chips. Now, this is where commercial researchers and commercial institutes meet together. People who are researching investigated topics along with actual researchers inside large companies. It's about adapting and applying fundamental research to industrial applications. Now, that's what companies like Intel would like to do. But on a basic level, this is an amazing collaboration between a large amount of researchers. And the key part here is how you can use simple, available materials, iron and gallium, a new process, complex though it is, but a possible one, to actually produce magneto-restrictive materials without relying on rare earth metals. That is pretty amazing. This paper was published in the journal Nature Communications. Lead author on this paper was Mesenheimer, Steinhardt and Sung, and a large number of collaborators from across the United States. Now, if you have a fancy TV or perhaps a phone or a computer screen, you may know if it has an OLED screen. Now, OLED stands for Organic Light Emitting Diode. Now, you know what an LED is, but an organic one actually relies on luminescent polymers, a certain type of polymer that has strong, you know, luminescent properties to actually use as its basis for emitting light. And these kind of luminescent polymers can be found in lots of places, not just TVs, but they're also in organic lasers, solar cells, sensing devices, bioimaging. Now, the problem is, they're really amazing. You get some great properties out of these luminescent polymers, but actually coming up with one and making one is really difficult. This is one of the reasons why those OLED screens that you might see, well, they can be found on the most expensive of TVs and phones. The research has been trying to find ways to eliminate all these complex, labor-intensive processes that take a lot of time and require multiple chemical synthesis steps. These things really slow down the applications of these amazing luminescent polymers to all kinds of new fields and products. So what can you do about it? Well, researchers from Hokkaido University in Japan have published in the journal Agadvant Chemi International. And lead authors on this paper include Koji Kubato, Naoki Tayoshima, and a large team of collaborators under the directions of Associate Professor Koji Kubato and Assistant Professor Mingu Jin. These researchers have been trying to develop a new type of luminescent polymer. But instead of developing some exotic material from scratch that relies on some complicated process to build, they turn their attention to generic polymers. Polymers that are relatively easy to synthesize, ones we already have large-scale industrial processes for doing so, and ones that are generally available. Things like polystyrene and polyethylene, PS and PE for those in the know. You'll be familiar with polystyrene from the packaging that you've probably seen, and polyethylene gets used in all kinds of products. Now, if you had a way to turn these run-of-the-mill polymers, generic polymers, into some kind of luminescent polymer, well, that's an amazing conversion. Like in the case where we talked about the magneto restrictions out of iron and gallium instead of rare earth metals. In this case, it's a way of turning relatively common polymers into a pretty amazing thing. Now, this would need a lot of special work. So how do you convert and remove all these complex chemical steps and processes that are normally done? Well, the simple answer is they squeeze. Now, this seems absurd, but instead of doing sophisticated chemical synthesis steps, they used what they refer to as mechanical stimulation. Now, researchers like Koji Kubato points out, it's well known that mechanical stimulating polymers, for example by grinding or crushing them, generates reactive species called free radicals. So inspired by this phenomenon, as well as our previous research into mechanical force-induced lumination reactions, we wanted to investigate if we could find a simpler method for preparing functional luminescent materials. Basically, it's well known that if you squeeze and you squash and you change and you scrape and you apply large amounts of force, you can get a luminescent response, particularly from certain types of polymer. That's great, but how could you do that in a way that doesn't destroy it and could be reused quite regularly? That is the trick, and that's what they outline in this paper. They place the polymers and pre-fluorescent radical actants together in a ball milling jar containing lots of stainless steel balls. This milling jar generally is designed to basically be shook with a large vibrating force. These balls move around and mill or grind whatever's inside it into some kind of paste. So when the jar was shaken, the balls move around and grind all those solid compounds Now, that mechanical stress actually initiates a reaction. And that's why they had those pre-fluorescent radical reactants placed in there, to act as something for this crushed polymer to now react to. During this process, the convolvulent bonds in the polymer change get cleaved in half. And that's really shocking for the polymer, but a great opportunity for those pre-fluorescent molecules that are just sitting around there in that jumbled mix, because they can slot themselves into that gap in that polymer chain. And when those pre-fluorescent molecules are inserted into the polymer, well, it just radically boosts the emission intensity of these polymers. So instead of faintly emitting a light, now they really emit a really big light. And these pre-fluorescent boosting molecules were inserted into the polymer not through some complex and gentle synthesis process, but through a violent, crushing and grinding one, but actually one that's really, really simple. And the thing is, this technique works on not just one polymer. It can work on polystyrene, polyethylene, polyphenylene, sulfide, polysulfolane, and other generic, commercially available and industrial-scale processes of polymers. Now, this is great because you could use this to induce other functions, to mix other types of functions into generic polymers, not just luminescence. This is a great way of using a different mechanism of actually mixing and melding something together. You could make a whole bunch of smart materials in this way for a wide range of applications, from bioimaging reagents in pressure-sensitive sensors through recording materials that change color in response to mechanical stimuli. This is the idea here, but it all comes back to a far simpler and more efficient way of getting the luminescent properties of these polymers boosted rather than relying on complex and really quite time-consuming processes of chemical synthesis. And as a person who really struggled with chemistry but loves mechanics, I love the simplicity of shaking some stainless steel balls around in a jar to really make a chemical reaction. This is a great paper published in the journal Akamant Chemi International with lead author Koji Kabato and other contributing authors Naoki Taoshima, Dayo Miura, and a list of collaborators from Hokkaido University.
This has been the Young Scientists of Australia's podcast, Lagrange Point.
From squishing and grinding, we can create new generations of materials, whether it be magnetorestriction or even luminescent polymer.
Our ending theme was composed by Audionautix. Head to ysa.org.au for more information about the Young Scientists of Australia.